Hello, and welcome to today's Zesty Garden. Did you know that you can grow all the fresh salad greens you need throughout the entire year, including the winter months, with no lights, no pumps, no greenhouse, and little more than a cupboard and a windowsill? I'm interviewing today Peter Burke. He's the author of Year-Round Indoor Salad Gardening, How to Grow Nutrient-Dense Soil-Sprouted Greens in Less Than 10 Days. Peter, welcome to Zesty Garden.
Thank you, Brian. Good to hear.
You know,
good to talk to you.
I was really intrigued when I saw this because I'm one of those folks that I'm kind of a lazy gardener, and I've wanted to grow things more indoors. My wife and I both love to eat salads, but
oh, good.
It's like, you know, I've got a humongous south facing window, but it's in the living room, and my wife doesn't want me growing stuff like this in the window. So we have another big window on the north side. So, like, okay, this sounds pretty good. So why don't you tell me where the idea for this book came? Was it kind of the same process?
Well, it came just about this time of year when I was closing up my garden and putting things to bed, and the one thing that I knew I was really going to miss was fresh greens. And you know, we make these wonderful salads from the garden all summer long.
And you're in Vermont?
Yeah, we're in Vermont, and all summer long isn't very long. And so I started experimenting with different techniques to grow fresh greens, fresh salad greens specifically. Because, you know, what you grow in the garden, you can either freeze or can or dry or, you know, store in a cold cellar. So the one thing that you can't do is fresh greens. So I looked at things like hydroponics and lights with shelves. And
sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, well, it is, and it's not as productive as you know as it needs to be, because in order to really grow a salad every day, you need to have a lot of lights and a lot of shelves to grow, or you know, a big hydroponics or a greenhouse. But a greenhouse is really only good through December, because here in January and February it gets to 10 degrees below or 10 above, and that's pretty much puts a greenhouse out of commission. So I started with sunflower, and I had read about and had in the past grown them in large trays. And so I tried those to start with, and then realized that it was feast or famine. Either I had too much or too little. Plus, I wanted to grow other things. I had heard about pea shoots, and the Chinese have been growing them for a very long time, pea shoots. And I had grown radish greens, and I wanted to try those. And so what I ended up doing was growing a little bit every day, so that I could not take up too much room in my kitchen and my, you know, on a window. I could have a fresh salad every day. And by doing that, you know, the sort of the small is beautiful principle, is it worked out so much better. I was really, really surprised. And this was in 2005, 2006. And so I started to teach classes on the technique, because I felt as though that would be the only way I could learn if this was really would work for other people. And it worked really well, and they had as much success as I did. And to give you an idea, and I like to emphasize that this indoor gardening, this indoor salad gardening, is not really a toy garden. It's very, very productive. In a space no larger than 20 inches by 72 inches on a shelf and cabinet combination, you can grow about 14 to 16 ounces of fresh greens every day.
So how is this different than the more traditional methods? Because
the more traditional methods, of course, is sprouts in a jar. That's the one more traditional. Were you thinking of any other ones?
No, that was the sprouts in the jar is what I was thinking. And
sprouts
the
in a jar is something that you have to rinse them three times a day.
That's too much work.
Well, it's sort of a logistical nightmare because where do you put the jars while they're draining? Well, they usually end up in the sink strainer, which is, you know, kind of competes for space you need to do your dishes. So with this method, I actually grow them in soil, and the first 4 days, I like to say, the first 4 days you do nothing. You put them in a cupboard in a dark place, and sort of a warm, dark place. And I have a cupboard right over my fridge that my wife has generously let me use for our sprouts. But any kind of warm, dark place will work. And what you're doing really is kind of forcing the seeds. They will grow in 4 days up to an inch, about an inch high, depending on your temperature. If it's a little cooler in your house, it might take 5 days. But, you know, once they get up to about an inch high in that dark place, their leaves are still yellow and they're starting to stretch out a little bit, I take them out of that cupboard and put them on a windowsill or, you know, a shelf or in front of a windowsill. And in front of a window. And it can be a north-facing window. It's absolutely fine. The rule of thumb is if you can see, you have enough light for these soil sprouts. And so you're just by doing a little bit every day. And you can, the really great thing is you can vary it so much. For instance, during the summer, sometimes you get to that point where the lettuce is bolted. You know, where it gets bitter and you just, and your lettuce that you've planted to follow along is not ready yet. Well, you know that within 7 to 10 days you can have a whole crop of salad greens. So it works really well to kind of fill in the garden in the summer. And then, of course, during the winter, if you don't have a garden, you can grow salad greens every day. And so, like, when my son comes home, he's one of those people who will have a sandwich, and he cuts off these sunflower greens, and he'll eat a whole tray on a sandwich. So if I know he's coming home, you know, I'll grow extra, you know, for him. So it's really easy to kind of to work with and adjust according to if it's just two of you, like my wife and I now, you know, with the kids gone, or if you know you're going to have you know, a potluck and you want a big salad, you know, it's pretty easy planning.
So tell me, we're really talking about, and we need to make it sure people understand, these are not microgreens that we're talking about. These are the soil sprouts. So why don't you talk about the difference between the two?
The five basic ones that I use, and there are other ones that grow well, but the ones that I use day to day is sunflower, peas, radishes, buckwheat, and some form of broccoli. And those make what I find is a really nice toss salad. It looks like, you know, sprouts in a jar, you put them in a bowl, and the kids go, ugh, you know. This looks like a beautiful, you know, toss salad. It's just a great-looking salad. And it has a variety of flavors and textures and...
But so, as far as they're taller, they're not what, like with the microgreens, you're getting a lot more leaf production, and that's where you need to have more light.
That's right. The combination of using the right seeds and using the right technique, you know, makes for a beautiful head of sunflower greens, a beautiful head of radish greens. These are 6-8 inches tall when you cut them, and they've got a nice long, juicy kind of crisp stem to them. And so you really, by forcing the seeds in the dark and the combination of that and using the soil, they really just take right off and you get this lush head of greens.
So for two people, how many of these would you have to be going at one time?
Well, for two people, and my wife and I, we grow, depending on how much salad you want, but we grow... 5 trays a day, and it's more than we need for dinner at night. So we box it up and put it and use it for our lunches the next day. If it was just the two of you wanted a salad a night, then I would just do 2 or 3, you know, of the small trays, the 3-inch by 6-inch. So I use 2 size trays, 3-inch by 6-inch, and a 4 by 8-inch tray.
So these look like aluminum bread pans.
Yep. Yeah, they do, and I use those mostly for my classes just because they're lightweight and easy, and it gives you an idea. At home, I use cereal bowls and just about anything. I actually got a nice set of stainless steel bread pans that are 4x8 and a nice set of stainless steel bread pans that were 3 inch by 6, the half loaf size.
So it sounds pretty inexpensive to get started.
Oh, gosh, yeah. You know, you have most everything. And it's these greens, I don't know if you've seen them in the market at all. The sunflower and the peas usually run between $20 and $25 a pound. You can grow them for $2 a pound without any problem whatsoever.
So let's talk about the soil.
Sure.
So you're growing these in soil and not in the jar, so you don't have to rinse them. What kind of medium are you looking at to grow these in? What works the best?
Right. The growing medium is not really soil or compost. It's your standard germination mix, which is peat moss, vermiculite, and perlite. And if you buy it by the bale, it's $30 or so. That'll last you easily a whole year. You can get it by a 20-quart bag, and you know it's probably enough to get started with. So that is called a soilless mix sometimes, or a sterile mix, but it's really just there's no dirt in it per se. And then I add a fertilizer, sea kelp and compost, and just a teeny tiny bit, not very much. And what that does is that as they approach 7 days or so, the fast-growing seeds like the radishes, you know, they might turn a little bit yellow after 7 or 8 or 9 days. So this gives them enough food to last right up through there. And it just sort of an empirical thing. I just kind of tried it and said, I wonder how this will work, and it worked great.
So when you're setting these up, do you normally soak the seeds or just basically wet them first?
Yep. Soak the seeds for quite a while, 6 hours at least and up to 12 hours max.
So they'll plump up and
they plump right up, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And what we're doing is, again, we're forcing them, you know, by soaking in water. That doesn't take, probably 3 or 4 days for them to soak enough water up to swell the seed up. So by soaking them, you know, we're cutting off time. And by cutting down the time factor, we're cutting down the space factor. So, you know, because we have a good-sized kitchen, but we actually don't have a huge amount of space. So by having a very fast cycle, 7 to 10 days, you only need, say, 35, 40 trays at most.
So you take
always cycling them through.
You have the tray, and let's talk about peas, for instance. So you've soaked them, and you're just placing them on the surface of the soil.
Yep.
You're not actually planting them into
that's correct.
Soilless medium.
I'm putting them right on top, and then to compensate for the fact that I'm not putting them under the soil, I take a real wet piece of newspaper, you know, and I soak it over 15, 20 minutes anyway, and then put it right on top. It's usually about 12 layers of newspaper, so it's usually 2 sheets of the standard newspaper, and, you know, you fold it up so that it fits right on top, and you tuck it down nice and all the way around, and this keeps the seeds nice and moist on the top side. Then you've got the moist soil on the bottom side, and that takes the place of, you know, burying them in the soil.
And
so that keeps the leaves cleaner.
And you're usually watering them every day?
Nope. The first 4 days is do nothing.
Oh, okay.
Once they come out and go on the shelf, you're watering once a day. That's all you should need. And you may have to adjust how much you water them every day, but it's pretty easy to, once you learn, you know, you can see, and if you pick up the tray, if it's real light, you know, it's you know, doesn't have enough water. You can do the Hef test, I call it, you know.
I also like in the book that you've got photos of everything, and you're showing, you know, what happens if you don't water on a day, and you come back and they're all completely limp, and how to get them revived.
You like the you can't mess this up section.
Yes,
right?
Yes, very much.
Well, of course, that is born of experience. I have made every mistake there is, and it's fun because you make a mistake and you learn. But a lot of times, you make a mistake and you realize, boy, this anybody could do this. You know, it's really hard to mess it up.
How do you avoid the damping off disease that sometimes
hits? Well, that's by the choice of the soil, the growing medium. If you were to use garden soil or even compost, and I have seen, you know, kits that have just straight compost in there, if you use those, you would definitely have problems with damping off and mold. And it was a really hard photograph to take. There's photographs in the book of real mold, because I had to do what I knew would make mold, and that's I just grew them in regular old soil. And so anyway, that's the way you avoid any kind of damp off. Just like just like in the greenhouse when they do sets or you know, plant starts.
Well, I want to open this up for questions to our listeners.
Sure.
If you have a question or comment for Mr. Burke, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to our Facebook page, Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and right at the top, you'll see today's program, and you can put in your question or comment there, or send us an email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Peter Burke is the author of Year-Round Indoor Salad Gardening, How to Grow Nutrient-Dense Soil-Sprouted Greens in Less Than 10 Days. So what do you like for color? You know, there's green.
Yep.
What sprouts give you some color? Because people like color in their salads.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm a huge fan, particularly when you get into December, January, February. The color on your windowsill, as well as the color on in your salad, is just it's great. You know, this really helps with the cabin fever. You know, so there are types of radishes. One is called Hong Vit radish. It's a Chinese variety, and it has a bright chartreuse red stem and a real dark, dark green. And it's just a beautiful color addition to your salads. So I like those a lot. The buckwheat, if you put it out on the shelf in the window, when it happens to be a really sunny day, they'll turn dark, dark red. And even though they have still the very light green, sort of delicate top. So the buckwheat gives you a nice red color. And then instead of broccoli, sometimes I'll grow purple kohlrabi. It's still in that broccoli family. Mm-hmm. It still has the nutrients that we like in broccoli. And it's just a pale purple, you know. But it's real pretty in the salad. So you put these colors together. And in the book, there's a couple of salad mixes that I like. You know, the red mix, which is all kinds of reds that you can do for a salad. And, I love the color. And then, of course, every salad that I make, I always grate up a carrot because, you know.
Of course.
It's available in the winter. And you could do the same thing with a beet or, you know. But that orange with the bright green and then the sunflowers have this a real white, white stem. And they're real crispy and they have sort of an opalescence to them, you know, where they sort of, you know, glow in their salad. Those are really wonderful.
So talk about, if you can, the nutrient density. So is it better for you to grow these rather than microgreens?
Well, if you're comparing them to microgreens, I would say they both are nutrient dense. You know, the really wonderful thing about growing these on your windowsill, and where the real advantage is that you're going to cut these, put them in your salad, and eat them. If you go to the store, you know, even your nice lettuces are 3 or 4 days old. Some of them are 3 or 4 weeks old. And, you know, the nutrient, just deteriorate over time. So there's absolutely nothing more local and nothing more, you know, full of nutrients than these that you grow in your windowsill and cut and eat just like that. Now, they're full of antioxidants, particularly the only one that's really been researched is the broccoli, and that makes a very interesting search. If you type that in, the sulforaphane, it's called, which is really a just a fascinating antioxidant in that it actually kills cancer cells, and there's been a tremendous amount of research done on that. And so that's one of the reasons that I decided to add broccoli to my garden, and was just because it was so rich.
So we have about 8 minutes left. Let's talk quickly about, you mentioned in here the importance of the water to dry soil ratio. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah. The soil mix that you get is dry. You know, it's light brown. It looks just like peat moss. And I use a ratio of 4 cups of water to the dry mix. And I'll do that either in a bag or in a plastic 1 gallon container or a 1 gallon pitcher, you know, like you use for juice. And by doing that, keeping that ratio right, it's not going to rot your seeds and have them too soggy, and it's going to provide enough moisture for those first 4 days while they're in the dark and you're doing nothing. And that's one of those things that I have found that by mixing that up ahead of time and having it all ready to go, you know, in the evening when I plant, I just put that right in, and I made the mistake of trying to put dry mix in and putting water in, and then, you know, it's hard to judge exactly how much water you have in there. So I've gone now to just pre-mixing everything in a gallon jug and a gallon container, and the ratio is 4 cups to 1 gallon of the dry mix.
And now let's talk about the harvesting part of it. I would want to try to reuse the soil, but of course it's going to have roots all through it. Is this something that you could, you know, compost, or do you recommend not reusing the soil just because of the pathogen issue?
Well, I have reused the soil just to see if I could do it. Of course, we have a big garden. We use the square foot garden method, and, you know, we've got 50-some 4x4 beds. And so we keep about 5 or 6 compost piles going all the time. And so this is the Browns, and it's just a great way to add green manure. Having said that, if you just simply let those dry out and crumple up the dry roots, you can reuse that potting mix, the germination mix. And so far, from what I've done, I usually don't have any problems with mold. Or damp off. So you can reuse it either way. You can either, you know, recycle it into your garden or reuse the germination mix.
I've noticed that you also have a screen that you can use to kind of help separate the soil out again if you want.
Yeah. That works really good. And so you get a root or two, but if they're dry like that, they usually don't don't give you any problems. If you find you're having problems, well, then you know. You just have to be a little bit more diligent. But once they're dried out, most of that stuff is pretty clean and pretty sterile.
And you really can grow this stuff in just about anything. I mean, there's a photo here of a dustpan that you've got these greens growing from. So
that's a wonderful story. My son, Jake, who has helped me a lot with this, with the classes that I do, he dropped one of the trays of pea shoots. And being a good kid, he went and got the dustpan and swept it into the dustpan. Being a kid, he, of course, just left the dustpan behind the wood stove and forgot all about it. 4 days later or so, voila, there is sprouts, there is pea shoots growing right out of that dustpan. So when I say you can't mess this up, I'm saying you can throw these things on the floor, sweep them into a dustpan, and put them in a corner, and they'll still grow.
So talk again about the 5 seeds that you recommend for someone to start with.
Well, the sunflower and the peas are probably the most popular, hands down. The radishes are just wonderful, and they are have every bit of the radish flavor that you expect from a full-size radish. They have a little burn to them. Not much. Certainly not like a jalapeno or anything like that. And then I love the buckwheat lettuce. It's a little futzier to grow because it has those hulls on it that has to drop off those hulls. But
oh,
if you let
right.
them grow long enough, the hulls all drop off on their own. And you have very little washing. You know, like you have with the sprouts in a jar, you got to wash those quite a bit because the hulls stay right with the greens. This way, the hulls just drop off.
But these
and
five...
So I like those quite a bit. And then the broccoli and all the broccoli family, you know, with this Chinese cabbage or, you know, the purple kohlrabi or just regular broccoli or all of those. Really easy to grow. They're very delicate. They're not big producers, but 1 ounce of those has as much sulforaphane as 4 pounds of fresh broccoli.
Wow.
So I figure that there's a tremendous value there in growing them, even though they're not hugely productive.
Well, this just all sounds delicious. And then in the back, you've actually got a chapter on recipes and what to include
each
one of those.
Yep, you can actually cook with the pea shoots and the broccoli.
Stir fry. I'm sure this would be great in stir fry.
Absolutely, throw them into to a soup at the very end. You know, they're great, and I think there's even a wilted salad that my daughter made up that we love. So, yeah.
Well, this sounds and it looks like a really easy process. I especially like days 2 through 9. Because you're not doing a whole lot. I mean, once you've planted 1 through 4, you're not doing anything.
Then
5 through 10, you're basically just watering every day, and then you
just
get to harvest.
Yeah, just once a day. And, you know, of course, what I love about it is I'm still gardening even in the winter because that's just something that it's a hobby for me and it's a passion. I love to do it. And so it's fun to have something to take care of and, you know. And then you get richly rewarded. It's every time I sow seeds and start all over again, I'm amazed. It works so well.
I'm guessing that you've just gotten so used to it that you would really miss it if you weren't able to harvest your fresh greens. Now, what about vacation? Do you have someone come in and take care of them while you're gone, or you just?
No. It doesn't take that long to make them. You know, you come back from vacation and you know. I just shut it down for a week or two, and, well, actually, I've never taken a 2-week vacation.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the program.
Sure, Brian, and what a great show you have. I've really enjoyed listening to the podcast.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. We've got
great
access to extension specialist here at the university. So.
Yep. Well, anytime you have questions, you know where to find me.
Great. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. I've been talking with Peter Burke. He's author of Year-Round Indoor Salad Gardening, How to Grow Nutrient-Dense Soil-Sprouted Greens in Less Than 10 Days. And it's from Chelsea Green Publishing. Thanks again, Peter.
Sure thing.
And I wanted to make sure I bring up a gardening calendar item before we move on to our next segment. And this comes from our a listener, Hillary Shugart, and great idea about how to take care of your carved pumpkins to keep them lubricated so they don't shrivel and dry up, especially when you have those intricate designs on the front. So one thing that she has read about and suggested and worked with is to apply a water-repellent lubricant to the cut areas. So petroleum jelly, vegetable oil, and even WD-40 will work wonders to keep the moisture in. Another option is to use a store-bought pumpkin preservative spray like Pumpkin Fresh, which contains a fungicide to kill the mold and lubricants to keep the pumpkin from drying out. And something that she said that she has used to preserve the uncarved pumpkin is try shining it with floor wax to keep it looking fresh. So thank you to Hillary for providing that. And Zesty Garden will continue after this break. Thank you for joining us on The Zesty Garden. In our segment where we talk about houseplants, I have Shane Taylor from Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. He's the horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals. And today we're going to talk about African violets. Now, this for me is one of those plants that evokes a lot of memories. My grandmother has them all over in her house. My mother has them in her house. And so, of course, I've got to have them in my house. And just the way that I am, I can't just have purple. I've got to have all of these different colors. This one's more of a, that you've got here in the studio is more of a mauve. That I've seen some with stripes, others with picotee around the outside edges. I just love African violets. Why have you selected African violet as a plant for a person to consider?
Well, like you were saying, Brian, the African violet is a bit of a legacy plant. And a lot of the African violets that those of us who have family members that have them, we received them from a leaf. I mean, did you, is that how you got?
Yeah,
that
my first one was from a leaf that got started in a just in medium. It wasn't even, I've seen some people try to propagate them with just sitting in water, but mine, we just stuck it in a
stuck it in some soil. And that's the way you're actually supposed to do it, is just stick them in soil and they'll propagate very easily. Even though a lot of people consider African violets kind of granny plants because they are, they've been around for so long and they've been popular for so long. One of the reasons they are popular is they're one of the few houseplants that will rebloom on a very regular basis. And it makes them a very effective little window plant to have because they'll just keep blooming and blooming, and they'll go through seasons of growth and blooming with fairly minimal care. They're just a great little plant, very easy to maintain.
And one of the things, though, that's very key to this plant is how you water it.
African violets are very sensitive to having water on their leaves. So if you're watering over the top of the plant, you'll notice the plant will either spot or at the very worst, it will rot at that point. So a lot of people will water their violets by allowing them to stand in water and slowly suck the water up. In fact, they make specific pottery just for African violets that lets water slowly in through the clay so that it doesn't end up overwatering it. But over time, it just is able to water it slowly, keep it from rotting.
And I've got two different kinds of pots. I've got one of the ones that you were talking about where it's like a pot that slips into another pot. And the one on the outside is kind of bulbous shape so you can fill water up and then it just slowly goes. It's a clay pot and it just slowly,
yeah,
the water goes in and the plant loves it. It
yeah.
absolutely loves it.
And they're self-watering pots, which is what they're called. They're a great option for African violets. You want to make sure, though, that whatever kind of container you have, ideally it should be a container with a glazed rim, like not just a regular clay pot, because that rim can
yes.
hold water and the stems of the leaves can touch that rim and they can actually end up causing rot. So you just want something that's either plastic or glazed or acrylic or something that's not going to touch water on the leaf for any extended period of time.
Yeah, this pot is perfect for that because it's glazed over the edge, but the other pot on the inside just kind of sits down on the inside, so that works. And then my other pots are plastic, but they've got a spot on the bottom so I can pour into the bottom of the pot itself, and then the plant just uptakes it.
Yeah, yep, and that's a great way to ensure that you're not getting the leaves wet. African violets are amazingly resilient. They don't need a lot of water. So even though these pots are designed to give them water over a longer period of time, I find myself only filling up my self-watering pots maybe once or twice a month. How about you?
I will do, if I'm thinking about it, when I walk in the house and I look over at the pots, if it looks like the plant has started to wilt a little bit, that's when I usually fill it up. And then what I'll do is do it two or three times in a row because the first time it just seems to suck it right up. And then as soon as I see it slow down, then I quit watering it and then it'll be 2 to 3 weeks at least.
They're amazingly resilient with that. The other things about African violets that you just have to watch out for is they'll only bloom when temperatures are warmer. It's usually above 65 or so is when they like to flower. So keep your African violets in a warmer spot. They like a little bit of sun. If you can give them an hour or two of direct sun every day, they're going to grow faster. The leaves are going to be darker green, and they're going to bloom more often. And of course, they like to be fed. You do need to feed them with a fertilizer that's intended for blooming. Almost every fertilizer manufacturer makes an African violet food. Just it shows you the popularity of the plants.
But is that necessary to have an African violet food? You just need to give it where the middle number of the three is higher.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's the most important thing, is just that phosphorus level in the fertilizer. But other than that, yeah, they'll do their thing. You just remove the old finished bloom stalks every so often, because they'll hang on to those. They'll hang on to their old dead leaves. So you just got to keep the plant clean. They have fuzzy leaves, so it's a good idea to take like an air duster or something and blow the dust off of them every so often, just because those leaves are like little solar panels. So you want to make sure that they stay as clean as possible so they can absorb as much light as they can get.
Now, my mother had in a north bathroom. I mean, there was a window there in the bathroom, but they were more like tiles. You couldn't see through them. And she had her African violet stacked above the toilet, right up against that window. So even though they didn't get direct sun, I still remember them doing pretty well. They probably wouldn't blossom as much as if they actually got some direct sun, but they seemed to do okay.
Well, and being native to forested region where they grow on the forest floor, they will bloom and live in indirect light. And that's something that they're used to. And it's like you were talking about the color, the purple, that is what you would find in nature. And so you'll find that color of African violet is going to bloom a lot more, and it will be more adaptable to lower light than, say, the reds or the whites or the pinks or the ones that have the stripes or the spots, because those cultivated hybridized versions aren't going to be quite as hardy for that light.
Yeah, I've got one in my office that's been going for 2 years, almost two and a half now. It has not stopped. So if anyone would like to have a cutting from mine, just let me know. I'm more than happy. It's a big, it's really good-sized one.
All it takes is a leaf, just one leaf.
And you just stick it in some soil?
Yep. The best thing to do is to stick it in soil, and all you have to do is take the leaf, cut it off right at the base of the leaf so that you even cut a little bit of the base of the leaf itself. If you have rooting hormone, which is a type of powder that pretty much any horticultural store will sell, you can dip it in that and then stick it in the soil. And then you just keep the soil a little bit on the dry side, water it maybe about half as often as you would your regular African violet. Let it go looking for water. And in about 4 to 6 weeks, you'll start seeing little tiny leaves come up. And within 3 to 6 months, it will develop into a plant.
Now, I've seen some older African violets that it looks like they're almost growing up into the air, because there aren't any leaves on the base of the plant. How do you take care of those?
Well, they get, okay, so violets will get stemmy and they'll get taller over time as those lower leaves die off and newer leaves come out the top. They become like little palm trees.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, you clean off all of the old dead leaves. Try to keep it as clean as possible. That helps it be as healthy as possible. And then in order to deal with that, often you can take it and bury it deeper. That stem will go right down in the ground. If you're in a pot that restricts how deep you can go, you can actually cut it right off the root ball, take several rings of the leaves off, dip that stem in rooting hormone, and then stick it down, and the plant will re-root. And I've had to do that on my own African violets several times now, especially as they get older. They just get taller, and my pots that I have them in are shallow enough that I can't sink them deeper, so I have to restart them that way.
So you literally just cut through that stem, and how far down below the leaves?
You want a few inches to be down beneath the soil.
You
probably want about 2 inches at the least to be down there, because those old leaf nodes are where the plant is then going to push out roots. So it's a good idea, again, to cover that wound that you created when you cut across the stem so that it doesn't absorb rot or bacteria. And then you would treat it just like you would a leaf cutting, where you'd keep it a little bit drier, because you're going to make it go looking for water. You're going to make it want to use the water in some of its lower leaves. So it'll lose another ring of leaves even after you've removed some, just using the energy from those leaves to create new roots. And at that point, it's a good idea to use an all-purpose fertilizer that's got a little bit more of that last number, that potash or potassium, to help them produce some healthy roots.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about African violets as a recommended plant to have in your home. I've been talking with Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
Happy morning to everybody out there. I'm Nancy Williams, and if you listen to me for long at all, you know that I have a passion for food and a passion for gardens, and so I love to bring you readings that involve both of them. So I've found one of those today. It's from a book, one of my favorites, called The Hills of Tuscany by Franck Maté, and it is from his chapter entitled Evil Women in the Monastery. So he and his wife are trekking through, being tourists at this point, looking for a house to buy in Italy. And this is sort of, I'm picking up in the middle of this chapter, so this is sort of lunchtime out there and goes into evening. They're walking and biking through this lovely countryside where a hawk is circling near the sun, correcting its bank only now and then, and there's not a soul anywhere. We walked on. On our right, a spacious clearing broke, and under a long wall that held the hill lay an abandoned brick piazza. Below it was an immense brick vasca, a basin of pharaonic proportions, maybe 50 strides long and 25 strides wide, and as deep as 3 grown men. It was only half full, with greenish water now. Its size and the immense sound of the bells warned us that something imposing lay ahead. We turned off the path. The piazza was warm with sun. We heard footsteps. On the brick path, a monk in white, his face hidden by his hood, shuffled with hurried care. There was a tiny chapel notched into the hill, its rosy plaster faded and peeling, its old wood doors cracked from the sun. About eye height were cut 2 holes to spy on those within or those without, and we pressed our faces against the warm wood to look in. A large peeling fresco of most pious saints hung above the altar. A few benches, old flowers, age. We sat down on the stoop of the chapel, me against the wall, Candace against me, closed our eyes and let the autumn sun soak down into our bones. Such silence. A dry autumn leaf brittled across the worn brick in the breeze. We sat. The bells tolled 1. It was time to eat. Few things spark me to life like the prospect of a Tuscan lunch. We followed the path back to the odor of roasting meats, and sure enough, on the terrazzo before the tower, in the sun-flecked shade of the jasmine-covered trellis, tables were set with white linen. We took one. My God, how well we ate. We were alone outside in that warm sunlight. A few locals wandered inside for lunch, and the 2 almost identical sisters who cooked and served brought us a continuously remarkable fare. There was homemade ravioli stuffed with ricotta and wild mushrooms, wild hare in a piquant sauce, roasted vegetables, and a red wine as robust as the day. Then ricotta with wild berries, then a great espresso, and long, slow grappa with our faces to the sun. It was almost 3. We were ready for culture. Past the vasca at the bottom of the path, the stark brick mass of the abbey erupted against the cypresses and the wooded hills. To the left rose a squat building, to the right an enormous square bell tower, topped by a turret in swirling patterns of scalloped brick that seemed from the Arabian Nights. But straight ahead stood the most striking part of all. Connecting the abbey to a massive tower, a 3-story-high brick bridge stood, transparent with its many windows and delicate, pillated, glassed-in arches above. And crossing the glass bridge in flowing white robe, strolling at a pace of gentle thought, was a hunched ancient monk backlit by the sun. Doors opened and shut. There was movement in the courtyard where the sign read, Camere degli ospiti, rooms of guests. The front door of the abbey was unlocked with a grating sound. We went in. There was no one anywhere. Glowing in the half-light were the sensuously smooth and hollow-worn terracotta floors. This professedly most ascetic of places oozed sensuousness at every turn. Its languid woods, its walk, the great Vasca, the see-through bridge, and now its leathery undulating floors. After the gloom of the entryway, we stepped out into the most sensuous place of all, the cloister. It was awash with the fragrance of gardenias. A vaulted, covered walkway supported by arches surrounded the great quadrangle of the courtyard. Life-sized frescoes adorned the walls under each vault, and those perfect arches were enclosed by leaded glass full of imperfections that distorted the golden light. And my God, what a courtyard! The brick pavement was strewn with terracotta vases, the bulbous kind that once held olive oil. The kind in which Ali Baba hid his 40 thieves. The vases were filled with torrents of orchids, sage, gardenias, carnations, and October Daphne. A plump, white-robed monk walked from vase to vase, pinching, watering. The frescoes by Signorelli and Sodoma were full of white-robed monks. They narrated the life of Saint Benedict, the founder of the order. His leaving school, leaving home, becoming a hermit, teaching and performing a mixed handful of ho-hum and impressive miracles. Most of them are set in dreamy landscapes. Most of them are filled with unique, passionate faces, and even more remarkably, with curvaceous, sensuous, voluptuous figures. Inserted among the austere monks are coyly posed, androgynous youths with seductively bared limbs or hips askew in paint-tight tights. And women of soft, languid limbs and dreamy eyes and dresses so tumbling, so filmy, they seem to be mere folds of colored light. There are in Sodoma's evil women sent to the monastery two such tantalizing, enticing women that I glance instinctively about to see if there might just still be one around. And Signorelli's coy, plump serving girl with her head innocently tilted and her skirt alluringly raised past her hip makes me stare in awe. They shouldn't allow so much wine at lunch, lest the visitors drown in a sea of impure thoughts. Then I came to the scene of Benedict, tempted in impurity, overcomes temptation, and I move quickly on, lest my impure thoughts get overcome and ruin all my fun. And beyond the naked columns, skin-smooth floors, and loose-limbed arches, we pass the door of the monastery's cantina and inhale the fragrance of aging wine. I glance down corridors at the humble, bedded cells, the rooms for guests needing a retreat, where one might honor and cherish one's lawful wedded wife. Awash in all this sensuous, who would dare call that sin? The bells toll and the walls tremble. It's 5:30, closing time. We walk down the empty corridors, down the long stairs, to courtyard's level, where a reprimanding monk stands and stares right at us. We halt. But it's a fresco. We hurry past the courtyard, over the silken tiles, to the big wooden door where an ancient monk awaits us, a live one this time, with caving features and bare head and hands clasped behind him. He watches us. We mumble Buenos Sera and step out onto the piazza. A pink-laced golden light has displaced the air. The walls are fiery above. A soft three-quarter moon snuggles near the tower. The long Tuscan twilight has begun. We walk long-shadowed, arms around each other across the piazza and begin the shady climb. A blackbird's cry rings from the walls behind us. Across the gorge, the hills have lost all substance, diffused into layers of undulating light. Autumn leaves flame near the Vasca. The sun lies in rare patches in the woods. A beaten earth trail leads up a tiny knoll. We go, climbing over steps of exposed roots with flickers of light to lead us. A broken travertine column, man-height, stands alone in the woods, with a rusty cross embedded in its top. With all the expanse of monumental architecture, all this art, this seems the only holy spot. Out on the road, a three-wheeled Ape comes chugging by. We wave it down and motion into its open back, and Candace says in Italian, "Un passaggio, per favore," and points to the top of the hill. The dusty bricklayer laughs and waves us aboard. The Ape chug-chugs feistily ahead. On the hilltop, before a small cemetery, we knock, get off, and wave goodbye. We walk into the olive grove and sit in the dry grass on the bluff. The monastery and the whole world lie before us, purples, yellows, pinks, and blues, but all washed, hazy, and indefinite, dreamy. The world was dissolving, vanishing, and if you have closed your eyes, you could see yourself from afar, dissolving in the haze. You could see yourself turning into light. I'm Nancy Williams. See you next time.